then when it's recorded, it will be recorded on YouTube.
Oh, okay. Okay, but so. you'll be able to manage that recording. I've got to go shut my door. I forgot to do that. You don't want 15 people walking in on it.
No problem, no problem.
Okay. And so how long do you think we'll go?
Well, how much time do you is I'm envisioning no more than an hour, but is an hour okay. Stretching it for you, or do you
it
need
might,
to get going?
It might be. We've just I'm a department head.
Okay, perfect.
I had this lapse of judgment.
Perfect.
Took that on. So I probably don't have to say a heck of a lot more, do I?
perfect. Yeah. Okay, well, I just kind of want to get my ideas out to you, and then. And then just hear what you're doing. I know you, like you said, when we had our little back channel, you're working with your students with real live clients and try to push them in the nonprofit social enterprise direction. So kind of just like to hear what you're doing. So
yeah.
Share
yeah,
my just, ideas on what I was kind of envisioning.
We might have Jay Wilson drop in too. He's a colleague of mine who's been working
perfect.
With me.
Perfect.
So that's he might walk in the back door.
That's actually something I've got my paper right here. I'm looking for names.
Oh, he's great. He's
oh, good.
He's trying something that's really cool. You may want to feature sometime. He's got a thing. Well, we call it Camp J. Uh-huh. But what it is he actually, we're mostly a distance program, but we're blended, right? We have some people who are local, some people from Egypt. It's kind of like all over the place. And we're just always kind of scattered and putting things together. Well, he found this location. The university owns a campsite north of Saskatoon, and he builds this entire class around an intensive camp experience. He pulls people in. He hauls a bunch of technology up. They work on a whole bunch of stuff together.
Oh, very cool.
It is fantastic. And then they go away, and they work independently and then check in with each other. And at the end of the experience, they have kind of a rollout of all their work and do all that.
Excellent. So excellent.
It is just super.
And well, should we just start? Let me just do a little intro that I can, like, clean this up.
Oh, sorry.
No. I mean, okay. This is how we usually do it on EdTech Talk, kind of the messy and the better. So.
Okay.
All right, so what are we calling this? Designers for Learning. This is our, and I'm calling it an on-air event rather than a webcast. I don't know, kind of more 2013. All right. Well, welcome, everybody. This is our first on-air event for a new project that is underway called Designers for Learning. And I reached out to one of my favorite virtual buddies, Dr. Rick Schwier, and I will let him give himself a quick introduction. And then I just wanted to thank everybody who's going to hang in there with us today. This is my first time being the audio lead on a webcast, so I'm sure there will be certainly things we can all laugh about at some point. But Rick, I just wanted to give you a second. Do you want to just give everybody a sense of, you know, who you are, what you do, and why you like this stuff?
Thanks, Jen. Jen and I have been pals for a long time. I'm going to send her up in just a minute on something. But my name is Rick Schwier. I've been at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatchewan, Canada, forever. And I teach instructional design. I've been really passionate about instructional design, but also about innovation and kind of moving the field. I've gotten mixed up with a whole bunch of people like Jen, who are always hungry to try new things. But I've been here for a long time. Ran our graduate program in Canada. We are probably one of, if not the leading. Graduate program in educational technology and design. Okay, there are other really great programs out there that emphasize other things. I'd say that we're probably one of the leads, if not the lead on that. And we have wonderful students who change our lives every day and year, and I've been doing this now for about 35 years. Just love it. I have no plans to stop doing it.
Oh, perfect. Well, this is exactly why I picked you for show number one. Yay. And just to give Rick and I had a little bit of an opportunity. When I say little, I mean 140 characters times, what, 8 messages maybe? So not a lot of time for me to explain to him what my thoughts are. But this is just a spark of an idea for a project that I've been gnawing on for about 6 months now. And now, without getting into a ton of detail, I've been doing a lot of freelance work. And some work that's come to my attention has been some nonprofit work and working with some social enterprises. And we can talk about what that means and the distinction. And so a very interesting project came up last year. And I reached out to the community using Twitter and listservs and things that I know. And I was amazed. I got 25 responses from students saying, we need to do internships, we need to do projects in our design classes, and I'd love to help. Unfortunately, when I reached out to the client, they weren't quite ready for it. They didn't want to work with students. I was not in a position where I was to be able to take on the lead of being the project manager. And I thought, oh, wow, let's take a minute, step back, try to formalize this in some fashion so that when we as a community have the opportunity to help out, work on a project, we'd have people lined up that are interested in doing it, and their technical skills would be laid out for us, and we'd know what folks were interested in. And so I tossed this around with various people, and they said, yeah, do it. So I've got enough people now to say, okay, yeah, now do it, that's where we're at. And so in a nutshell, that's kind of my long story. And so really what I'd love to be able to create is almost like a match.com for instructional designers. So whether it be freelancers or it be students, when these project ideas come up, that we have, again, a platform and a community space for the request for proposal to go out, and then have, again, students, professionals, however it might be, take a shot of the project by putting together some type of proposal for what they'd like to work on. And then I think it'd be super cool if we as a community then could kind of talk people, especially students, it'd be a great opportunity to talk them through some ideas, like why don't you try this, and engage the greater community in trying to figure it out. So that's fine.
I love that. Match.com for ID.
Yeah. So that's kind of my idea. So it's a matter of whether it could happen. So if you notice, I think most of the people are probably catching us over at EdTech Talk. And if you're not, we have a studio set up at edtechtalk.com/live/D4L. And if you head over there, if you're not there already, we have what's called a Titan Pad. And it has like a wiki on one side where I was able to kind of lay out my thoughts of things. If we get through some of these, it'll be great. But these are some of the things I'd like to start talking to Rick and others about. And then on the right side of the page, we have a traditional text chat, which you're very much welcome to add your 2 cents or 3 or 4 cents along the way as we're speaking. But so, Rick, what do you think of this idea? And how does this kind of play in with what you've got your students doing as far as requirements in your program?
Well, I love it. I mean, what's not to love about this? I mean, one of the things that we've been struggling with over the years, but really it's become kind of a feature of how we're trying to do things more and more, is to build environments that are authentic and to tie in the learning, kind of backfill the learning with experience. I mean, or actually have the experience take the lead and then bring in the learning and wrap it around that experience. And God, it's tricky, but you need clients, don't you? You need people who are willing to work with you and take a chance on you. And you also need students who are willing to take a chance on a lot of things, too. I mean, I can get into that, but we have some nicknames for our classes and things like that as a result. Some of them aren't too kind. But as a result of really trying to push out our expectations into the community and really take that seriously. Go beyond even a community service learning model and really turning it into a community collaborative model. And we've had some experience with that now. In our entire program, by the way, I should mention that we are really trying to more and more build it around self-directed learning, too, which is really tricky about how do you plug in and then not. And then we're also trying to we're also doing this in an environment that's largely completely blended, but it's you're able to take our entire program online. So how do you build authentic experiences with a client base and do all that kind of stuff and then have online students messing around with this stuff? It really creates a tricky environment to navigate.
Absolutely. This semester, I'm teaching at Old Dominion a consulting skills class.
Yeah.
And fully at a distance. We meet every Thursday for too long, actually. Probably 3 hours is too long for an online class.
Really?
Yeah, that's a separate issue. But one of the requirements for the students will be that they need to go out and find a client.
Yeah.
And so it's hard enough if we were all sitting in the same place and that we could walk across the street and meet with, you know, Joe's Ice Cream Shop or whatever it may be. I'm going to be dealing with some of the things you're talking about as far as the being far away. But then getting into kind of the devil of the details of just doing consulting work in general, I think we do a great job as a field teaching people how to do instructional design work.
Yeah.
I think we're probably not as great because, as you said, it's hard to do. It's hard to carve out time and find clients to actually get into those kind of soft skills, the relationship building, project management, scoping out a project, you know, those types of things. And I think from experience, I think the only way to really do it is to get your hands dirty and do it. So it's going to be a messy experience for me this semester.
Well, you know where some of this started for me a long time ago? You just reminded me of something. A long time ago, I did a small research project with a dozen or so instructional designers, and I asked them one simple question. And it was just, what do you do in your jobs that isn't instructional design?
Okay? Right.
What's all the other stuff that comes into your jobs? And it was incredible. The stuff that they don't classify as instructional design that they were doing all the time. Like you say, I mean, it was everything from, you know, being a peer counselor to a marriage counselor to an apologist for an area, to somebody who could juggle five areas at the same time. And I looked at a lot of what they produced and I thought, hey, I knew that was part of instructional design. And actually, I gave the paper at AECT, and it was something Dave Merrill said. He said, what do you mean? This is part of instructional design. Of course it is.
Right.
And of course it is, but we don't teach it. We don't address it. We don't deal with it in any real way. And I thought, there are all these hidden lessons about doing instructional design that are just floating around the edges, and a lot of times our students are left to find those out on their own later after they're out and employed.
Or when they're on their interview. They're on their first interview and someone asks them, can you tell me about a project you managed, and can you tell me about when things started going wrong and how did you get things back? I know you're a very, very busy guy, so I'm very, very happy to get you some time with you. So I just want to hit a few things that I have over on the on the Titan Pad. So I think I did a high-level overview of what I'm talking about, and I think there's general consensus that in some respects there's a problem or a need or an opportunity that we can, at least from the supply side, that we're interested in finding a way. I think what I've been doing behind the scenes is working here in Chicago, going to a lot of meetings with nonprofits, and I joined the Chicago's chapter of the Social Enterprise Alliance, trying to get an understanding. They don't talk our language. They don't know what instructional designers are. They know they have volunteers that need to be trained. They know they have instructional materials that need to be produced, but you know the language is different. So I'm kind of working on that.
Yeah.
But I'd love for this platform also to be a place where people, when they hear about an opportunity, maybe something that they need at their own organization, that they would have a place to, again, present some type of request for proposal and say, here's what I'm looking for in my language. What can you, you know, how can you turn that around? And then in terms of what schools are doing, I know you've got the project and portfolio requirement. I linked to something. Mm-hmm. I think it's close to what you're currently doing. And then other schools such as BYU, they have an internship requirement, which also then has a client-based requirement where you have to find a real-life client.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily, I don't think, confined to the scope of a semester, which is another issue, trying to find projects that can be started and finished in 15 or 16 weeks.
Exactly.
And so what I'd be interested in hearing, if you know or if others know, if we could just start a dialogue on what other instructional design programs require. And so who I could start reaching out. And you started to describe Jay. I don't remember Jay's last name. And
Jay Wilson.
And you want to just kind of run through what you were starting to say when we were setting up the webcast?
Yeah. Well, I've been working closely with two of my colleagues, actually, Jay Wilson and Dirk Morrison, both of whom are instructional designers, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been really worried about this whole how do we build authentic environments and do that in a distributed environment and a mixed environment. And one of the things that we ran into early on is that in some we try it a lot of different ways, and it works differently in different courses. Sometimes we do exactly what you're talking about. We send, and what BYU sounds like they do, we send students out and we say, you need to find a client. You're going to work on program evaluation. So in that course, you go find a client and you conduct a program evaluation. You negotiate it, you discuss it with them, you're guided through the process by your instructor, but you actually do everything around managing that project. In our instructional design stream, we handle it quite differently. I had a really couple of disasters happen the first time I tried this, yeah. And it ended up costing me an entire summer going back and fixing some stuff we'd committed to doing, and it just didn't come through. And you know, it was my fault. I missed some stuff along the way. Our students were great. But I found that it was asking too much of them to do all of the project management, all of the stuff, and then expect them to also bring in a project to completion in, we have 14-week semesters here. So it's tight to begin with. So, by the way, Jen, just stop me if I start rattling.
You're hitting on a lot of things that actually wake me up in the middle of the night when I'm thinking, okay, I'm putting myself out here saying I want to help students. I just picture myself going, oh, my gosh, I committed to 25 clients that we would have this done, and then I'm the one sitting exactly. there at midnight trying to, you know, type out a...
And it can happen. It has happened. We'll show scars sometime. But... So I stepped away from that model, and the next time I taught the class, I took it on myself the semester before we taught the class to go out and find a client. And I went and interviewed clients. I'd reach out to people, or I'd hear about somebody who wanted something done, and I'd go talk to them, and it took a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And so I spent much of a semester prior to teaching the class just negotiating a memorandum of understanding about what was going to go on. And we can share the link to that one article. I think I've got a copy of the memorandum in there and all kinds of stuff like that that people could crib all they want. But that takes a lot of time. But what it allowed me to do was find two things. One, a client that was absolutely committed to learning is the biggest part of the model. So they understood that they may not get a completely finished, polished product at the end, and they're okay with that. They understand that the main goal has to be a solid learning environment for my students. But the other thing is I needed somebody who would have, they'd define one person who would sign off for us. I don't want to deal with a board of directors. I found that out very early mm-hmm. on. Boards of directors just drive it nuts, especially in the nonprofits. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I wanted that one sign-off person, and then we would negotiate the details of what a project might look like. Now, ours is a graduate program where we're working arm-in-arm with our students all the time, okay, in all kinds of environments. We've got them hooked into our research programs where we can. Even when they're online, we have a really good sense of community. So what I try to do is with one or a few, or as many as are willing to, really, come along with me and attend those meetings, those negotiation meetings with me, with the clients. My thought is if they aren't doing the negotiation, they can at least see it being done firsthand, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then they can kind of spread that around with the other students who didn't get in on that part of it. But it's such a critical part of the project management piece, right?
Right, absolutely, yeah.
And I know they're going to lose that by me doing that for them, but I also know we're going to end up having a project that can be done. Because the other thing I forgot to mention was I'm looking for a project that's that big.
Yeah.
I don't want one that big. Mm-hmm. And it takes some experience, as you know, to recognize when a project is that big and when it's that big. And sometimes you still get it wrong, even if you're experienced. It's given things.
And you know, I put down in the... things to talk about later. I'm not sure if you're familiar with an organization called Taproot Foundation, and they've got a website. I put the link in here on the wiki side of the TitanPad. It's taprootfoundation.org, and basically they're a nonprofit set up to offer pro bono work beyond just law. You know, you typically think of a lawyer, you know, pro bono work. Mm-hmm. And so that was another thought I had, is that if we would actually use their platform, because what they do, all everything you're just talking about, they pre-qualify the client, they scope out the project, they negotiate the terms, and then but the only problem with that is I think then the students do miss that opportunity to at least sit in like the passenger seat and see what's happening in those negotiations.
Yeah.
But then they would be drawn on, as you're saying, a very itty bitty project. We need a script written or whatever the design thing is, and it'll take you 30 hours over the course of 10 weeks to get it done, or some sense type thing like that.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, then the trade-off is then they're missing some pieces of it. But I was also wondering, too, if you thought there would be any potential for this, where you'd reach out to, like, the Bill Fitzgeralds of the world, or those that actually have real clients they work with, you know, all the time, and they may be able to tap into the pool of talent that we have. So Bill, it would be a for-fee project that he's working on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I haven't reached out to him particularly, but I'm just wondering if
they're... You're setting it up right now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I did reach out to him about the one, and that's another thing. I mean, he runs a business, so I reached out to him, the one I had over the summer, and I said, here it is for you. And I think that one was a tad small, actually, for what they would be interested in, plus it was remote. He's not in the Chicago area, and this was here, and that brought up some other issues, which we all know. It's nice to say you want to work on these projects, but it's when you start actually laying out all the variables that it gets a little bit more confusing. But I think that would be also interesting, too, is if we did have a project come to our attention, and then you had, I think it would be kind of cool, I don't want to say competition in that, you know, you'd be fighting for business, but just to see, okay, this is how Group A would approach it. This is, they'd be their project manager. This is how they'd scope it out, and then you'd have another do the same.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a lot of these things don't fall neatly into the spectrum of a semester, but I think when I propose this to other people, there are a lot of people like me that maybe have 10, 15 hours a month that they wouldn't mind devoting either to a low bono or pro bono project.
Yeah.
Or even for fee. God forbid we collect money for what we do.
the only reason I've steered, well, not the only reason, but one of the reasons that I've steered away from active contracts is we graduate people who go out there and try and make a living at this stuff, and I don't want to be in competition with them.
Right.
You know, I want to protect our own alumni.
Well, and it brings in a whole bunch of other issues. Yeah.
Now in Chicago, you're big enough to get away with that and not cross paths. You know, you don't run into problems like that, but we actually do. And unfair competition from the university is a big issue.
Yeah.
In our town, and so we have to be careful about how we play that game, but. The other more sociable reason is that we just like the notion of, in our approach to stuff, we talk a lot about social agency.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we want instructional designers to think about themselves as more than people who produce stuff and get paid for producing that stuff. Or, you know, even good instructional stuff that has legs and does good things in a lot of different ways. We want our instructional designers to get a little bit of a sense of themselves as having a bigger mission that they can serve with the skills they have. I mean, they have some powerful skill sets when they walk away, and to think of themselves as more than people who can just go in and fit a position. You know, they can end up working at WestJet, or they can end up working at Intuit. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more. There are other possibilities out there too, and a greater good to be served. And we're a university, and so we need to think about those things anyway. So I just like that feel of it.
I do too. I put it in there as a question somewhere buried in my wiki. There is the pro bono, low bono, or fee, and the whole idea: does it necessarily need to be nonprofit or those with a social mission? And for me, that's the draw because. You know, if I want to be an instructional design firm, I'll go be an instructional design firm.
And
plus, I think I don't want to say that we'd shortchange the nonprofit because we're not being paid, but there is a different standard when you're saying, well, we're doing it for free. We're doing the best we can.
You know, there is. But even that, from an instructional point of view, it's kind of my fail-safe area that I think, okay, well, if we completely screw it up, I can at least go into the client and say, oh, I'm really sorry, but we did the best we could.
We did the best we could. We're learning. We didn't charge you. You know, no harm, no foul.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah. So that works out really well. And the one thing I've never seen from any of my groups going out and doing any of this kind of work is less of an investment or a more casual approach on their part. They sit up straight. They are into this in a big way. And we pitch it that way. Our motto is on time, on budget, and beyond expectations. Mm-hmm. And we this is a mantra. Every week when we get together, we're saying on time, on budget. Are we on time? Are we on budget? Are we going beyond the expectations of the client? And we want that every time. And I know it sounds almost silly, but that sets a tone that people really respond to. Right. And they understand that their obligations are bigger than what's written in a syllabus.
Right. And I think I mentioned I had 25. I wrote a very small email out to the IT listserv, and I was just amazed. Some of the personal stories, actually, the personal connection with what the mission of this organization was. It happened to be a heroin addiction project that they wanted to work on. I had people giving me very personal stories about their connection to this issue. And whatever it would take, they would love to participate, and which ties into what you were saying earlier about the whole social mission. And then, like, finding 25 people that on one email would send me a resume saying I'll help out however I can. It's pretty cool.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? I love your idea, by the way.
Oh, good. Good.
I love your original idea. But that idea of saying we've got one project, let's put different teams on it and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
I love that idea. I'm going to steal that idea. Because sometimes we end up maybe with more students than projects or something like that. And it would be really, really neat to see how instructional design manifests itself differently with different groups.
Well, and that's a skill set in of itself, bidding the project. You know, even if you don't have the time to actually complete it, you know, if we can find a way to do that. Plus, I think it's wrapping the idea of community around the discussion of best ways. We're very good about throwing out MOOCs and do this or do that. But like, when we actually have a real problem or an opportunity in front of us to say, oh, wow, I think this would be a cool option for you to consider. Why don't you try doing that and have an open discussion surrounding the project.
I do, too. And the thing is that I think students just respond so well to it, and that their growth is phenomenal. I mean, when they're in there, you've seen it. When they're in there doing the real projects, holy! One of the issues that I run into with it is always trying to find space to be metacognitive about what we're doing.
Not yet.
You get so wrapped up in the project and doing the project that I'm always wanting to pull them out of it and say, okay, let's go back to 30,000 feet. What are you learning about doing instructional design from this? And that's an exciting conversation, but I found that that's really a hard conversation to get people into sometimes.
Yeah, and I'm actually making, I usually do this, I don't usually have a quantitative requirement as far as blog postings, but this one I'm telling them every week you have to sit down and force yourself to write 600 words, a minimum of 600 words, which is about a page, of what's happening on your project. And even if nothing happened, then say, oops, nothing happened, but this should have happened, or the scope is changing, or I had a weird conversation, now they seem to be talking about, you know, Z, and I've never heard about Z. Why do I have to do those are the types of things, like you said, you almost have to have a snapshot in time thought process of what's actually happening.
So. How do you tie it into the literature? How do you cook the literature with that kind of a course? We've got an approach, but I don't know if it's good.
It's the whole, and this is really getting inside baseball here, but it's the whole difference between ID and HPT, human performance technology. So I'm very much going down. I think they do. It's unfortunate. I think we really disregard a lot of the stuff that's been done and written in HPT.
I think you're right.
And so I'm using Block, the Bible of consulting, the book, and then also one of Judith Hale's field books, performance consulting. Field books. Those are our two main texts. And then I'm pretty much going to business literature, some business journals, Performance Improvement Quarterly.
Oh, okay.
There's not a lot out there. I'll agree with that. But
One of the things I've been doing just from a structure in the class is here was my concern. that we get so focused on the practicalities of ID and even talking about the practicalities of ID and even the theory that ties into it, that one of the hidden lessons that I wanted for my folks to be getting is instructional designers refer to literature. Mm-hmm. We approach these things in a scholarly fashion, or we should. Mm-hmm. And that isn't the first thing we think to do. We may just ignore that there may be something out there. So I have regular requirements that people go dig out literature that informs them in some way about the project they're on.
Right.
And then they have to create, we have different kinds of postings that we do with that kind of stuff. It depends on where the class is and how they're mixed and stuff. But they've got to talk about, they've got to situate that reading in the project and say, okay, mm-hmm. I found something that helps me. And you're quite right. It's not often in the instructional design literature. That's right. Interesting. It's often related literature, but stuff that they're bringing in, even from learning sciences. Sometimes my students don't even differentiate which kind of orientation they're in.
Yeah.
It's a discrimination they don't care about.
I taught last semester was an HPT class and Introduction to HPT, and we had a couple weeks on that. It's like, where's the research base? And it's kind of cool. You know, it's either you can be viewed as a positive or a negative. It doesn't have a strong independent research base, some could argue. Mm-hmm. But they're also very willing to go out and grab from other places, which I think in instructional design we don't, you know, we kind of get in our little insulated echo chamber and we aren't quite as willing to go out.
And I think that that's one of the places where we stop acting like designers, and we've got to be better about that. I think it's something to really pay attention to. Designers don't confine themselves to a box, right?
Right. Yeah, and I think that's cool. I've listened to Andy Gibbons talk about, he reaches out all over the architectural design and all these different design books and the whole thought process of design, and I think that's kind of cool. So.
Yeah. By the way, I ran across a...
How much time do you have?
It's okay. I've got another 15 minutes or so. But I was just going to mention that I ran across a neat resource, and I don't have it at my fingertips. I didn't think about it ahead of time. But a neat resource for the classes, it's a website that Dave Wiley and some of his students put together on consulting in ID and project management in ID. So have a look at BYU stuff and it's online. It's available. You know, Dave. It's out there and available.
Right.
And it's really served a nice purpose in the class because my students were actually using it as a constant reference. I have a couple of my students will act as project managers or team managers because I'll have more than one team working, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'll kind of be the overall. Project manager, I guess.
Okay.
But really, they're team managers, and so they're looking into it. And so the people who are acting as team managers particularly loved having a practical reference with a lot of examples in it that they could refer to, so they have a sense of what to do. I mean, that's foreign territory for them.
Have you read any of Judith Hale's stuff? She's just a very hands-on, this is how you do it. I've done this for 75 years.
Yeah.
She's in Chicago ISPE chapter. She speaks frequently, and she just rolls up her sleeves and says, you know, here's the dirt. Yeah. If you do X, Y, and Z, you'll run into these problems, so don't do that. Do this. And, yeah. Kind of fun. But her book is written just like that. It's just very very practical application of instructional design. And
I'm trying to remember if I've got it. I'm going to have to turn around and go to my shelf again because I know of her and I know her work, and I'm trying to think if I could lay my hands on it right now.
I grabbed my copy, but it's on my Kindle, so you wouldn't be able to see it anyway. So. Very good. I guess what my next step would be is I think I might, if you don't mind making an introduction to Jay and Dirk, maybe I could get them to chat with me sometime. Any other names out there of people that might like to play along and help me in the...
I'll put an entire list of people together with you because I think our friends at Indiana University would be all over this stuff.
For sure. I think Elizabeth Bowling's been doing a studio class for years, right?
Forever. Mm-hmm. And then I'd look to Georgia, too. I mean, Jeanette Hill and some of that gang out there, they've been just – and Lloyd Reber, great stuff. I mean, some of the folks who've been around a while, we haven't aged badly. You know, I still see a bunch of radicals out there, people who are willing to try and do new stuff.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
And it is neat to see that. So Elizabeth and Kenan Smith and I are working on, but there are several of us, and Katie Campbell University of Alberta. She's fantastic. If you haven't worked with Katie before.
No, these are a lot of, I know some of the names, but I have to admit, I feel bad. I don't know a few of the names you've rattled off. So.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Oh, great. Excellent.
But anyway, we're working on a book about design, you know, studio design teaching, or studio teaching of design, and we'll bring in people from a number of different disciplines, but mostly instructional designers. I just think that this whole area is just ripe for the picking right now. People are excited about different ways to do it, and I think we've gotten a sense. Everybody I talk to, I don't think I'm overstating it when I say our entire field started to feel pretty stale. You know, we weren't aging gracefully. our stuff felt old, and I think all of us, and we knew that the stuff was good and it had utility, but we needed to reframe how we were doing. We needed to rethink kind of the shape of how we were teaching it and thinking about it, and we were missing big gaps of stuff like how do other design disciplines approach design?
Mm-hmm.
We weren't paying attention to that. We were just plodding along doing it the old way we always did.
And I would almost argue that we've almost, in some respects, gone sometimes too far the other side of pie in the sky. And like when you actually start talking to a real client who needs something done, it's like you said, they've got internal politics to deal with, and they've got decision makers on their side. And
what
we may think is very cool and neat and open, we can't have open. We can't put our clients' information, so all our ideas that are we talk about in Twitter or whatever, when you go to apply them in real life, you sometimes run up against a wall.
Isn't it fun to be ahead of the curve for a change?
Yeah, right.
I felt like I was clawing to get up there or something.
Exactly.
But you hit on a really important point there, Jen. I think we can't forget that we've got a tool set that still people need, mm-hmm. you know? We've got to talk a common language in our fields. I mean, just like artists haven't stopped using brushes when they design stuff, we better know how to write some objectives and be able to lay that out. It better be congruent with some evaluation. You've got to be able to do some of that basic good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In our approach, what we do have a tool skills, an ID tool skills class that precedes ever going out and touching a client. Okay, one of the big here's my bug about it, is that people originally, I'm talking about my own students in our own program, they thought they discovered the Holy Grail. When we teach them the basic tool sets, holy, they could go out and build cathedrals with it.
Right.
And they could in some cases. That's just it. Like you say, if they got into with the right set of clients and the right kind of problems that they were trying to solve, well, that was just the right tool set to go after. But what I was uncomfortable with and what I'm getting more and more comfortable with is get that basic tool set, but then what we want to do is disrupt your learning.
Right.
We want you to see that one of your jobs isn't to learn an instructional design model and apply it, but to create a model that's appropriate and sensitive and responsive to whatever context you run into. And that means you've got to start experience. You got to take that experience and you start got to keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger. Your learning keeps having to grow bigger so that whatever that context is you find, you can respond to it. Or you'll know you can't yet.
Right.
Maybe you have to hand somebody off to a better instructional designer or a more appropriate one.
I don't know if you and I have ever had the conversation, but I came at this field. I have my MBA in strategic management and marketing. So, like, I view all of these. I look at kind of the bigger picture, like how the relationship management, the project management, the strategic planning, the analysis piece. Those are just skills that are required no matter what project you're working on. I don't care if you're building a bridge or whatever it is, designing instruction. Yeah. And then, as you're saying, that extra set of skills that we bring to the table as instructional designers, that's when we can have fun. You know, fun and creative, and but at the end of the day, when you're working you know, those are just skills you need to know. You have to keep people informed. If they stop talking to you, there's a problem. If you realize you haven't talked to your client in a week, that's probably a problem. You know, those types of things you don't know until you really start working with clients and understanding how that relationship works.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that whole relationship piece is a really big piece that we need to do more work on in structural design. But Elizabeth Bowling had told us one time, we were at a group conversation one time, and she made the most remarkable statement. I don't even think she realized how remarkable it was, but it knocked me right over. She said, you know what, when she was doing her Master of Arts I think she was at Texas State. Anyway, where did Bobby Knight go? Texas Tech. That's where she was. Okay.
Bobby Knight. Like I would. Oh, by the way, sorry about last night. Sorry about last night. That didn't quite go your way, did it?
I don't know what you're talking about.
For those that don't know, my Wisconsin Badgers went on their court. And came home the victors.
Tell me it isn't so. For the 11th time in a row.
Although I couldn't lose. I got my master's at Indiana and my undergrad. I guess technically I couldn't have lost. Sorry, I am sorry.
I shouldn't have embarrassed my guest like that. I was waiting to pounce on you about that anyway. I can't tell you when I saw that score last night. Oh my gosh. But what Elizabeth said was that even in that art and design program, they had the equivalent of the ADDIE model. She said, but that wasn't what we focused our learning on. We kind of dealt with that and dealt with it early. She said we learned ADDIE the first week and then we moved on to everything else from that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, you know, that may be overstating it, but I don't think by much. We've gotten so focused on model-based mm-hmm. design. And that's nothing new to the conversation, and I don't want to tread over old territory. I know that that's almost a cliche in our field now, but we did. Mm-hmm. And I think exploring those new approaches to design is valuable. I think you're quite right. Sometimes we give people the sense that they can go out and lead the charge on open education resources, and they're going to end up with a corporate client and say, yeah, we're going to put all your stuff online and everybody will love it and you'll share it with all your competitors.
Yeah.
And they pretty well barf all over you when you do that. It's not pleasant. So.
Yeah. No, exactly. Oh, this has been so exciting. I've had these ideas and I, you know, kicked them around and everyone's like, yeah, like I said, oh, cool, yeah, go for it. But you kind of just have to start. And so that's where we're at today. And I do want to tell people in the chat room, thank you to Peggy and Lisa. I see you're typing away over there. I just can't multitask very well. So I'll have to go back and read what everybody's read. And I do welcome anyone. I do have a website that I created at designersforlearning.org or com. Or info. I think they all go to the same place. And feel free to add comments there if you're interested in participating. You know, find me there. Find me on EdTech Talk. Send me whatever. However, I'm on Google Plus and Twitter and all sorts of places like that. But I'm so excited that you're excited. And
oh yeah.
If you could point some people my direction, and if I could bounce some ideas off you going forward, I'd really, really appreciate it.
Oh, I'll be glad to do that. And what's not to be excited about? This is the golden age, the best time to be alive in instructional design. I'm sure of it. And we don't even know where all this stuff's going, and that's the most exciting part, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's like you said. You know, you can get yourself drawn into the whole, oh, it's a dying field and no one is blah, blah, blah. And then on the other side, this work is here. Someone's doing it. And if we're not going to take the initiative and go do it, someone's going to do it.
Yeah,
so we better do it.
It's probably obvious to you that I don't fit into that it's a dying field camp.
Yeah.
I think this is a field that's just poised to take off. And we can't bring people out of our program fast enough for the demand that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you for being part of show one. Oh. I think we streamed the whole thing. I don't think we lost audio or video. Cool. And thanks, everyone, for having patience with us. So my plan for the future, I'm trying to do this every other week. So we'll try to get two in a month. And I think I'm going to tap, if you don't mind, Jay and Dirk, maybe for my next two friendly faces or whoever. I'm going to let you be my my talent agent for a few shows. If you can seed me some names, and I'll...
Well, this could turn out to be the All Saskatchewan All the Time program, too. So I think you'll love these guys.
I've joked for years with Dave Cormier that I think I'm part Canadian because I tend to gravitate to you guys.
You're definitely an honorary Canadian, but I don't know about this whole Badger Hoosier thing. We're going to have to sort that out, Jen.
I know. Now it's going to be a tough one. You want to kind of pull me away from that? That might take a while. Well, thank you so much, and get back to your
My
real
pleasure.
Job, and we'll keep everybody posted on how things are going. Thanks, and thanks again for everybody for joining.
Thanks, Bye-bye. Jen. See you later, buddy.
Bye-bye.